This week's podcast is brought to you by Molecule Air Filters. Air filtration is more important than ever, and it's not necessarily because there's more pollution in our cities, which of course there is, but there's more pollution indoors. Many people don't realize that your furniture is off-gassing formaldehyde, household cleaners and chemicals are coming off of your dishwasher and your soaps and your furniture and so much more. HEPA filters have dominated the industry for years. Molecule reinvented the home air filtration system with something they call PECO technology, P-E-C-O, and it destroys pollutants at the molecular level. Just for listeners of the Lucas Rockwood Show, you can save 10% off your first order if you go to molecule.com, M-O-L-E-K-U-E-L.com, and enter the promo code ROCKWOOD10 at checkout. You'll get 10% off. Thanks to Molecule for sponsoring the show. One of the recurring questions I get on the podcast is, Lucas, how do I make change in my life? And very often people are writing in trying to commit to a healthy eating plan, trying to commit to a meditation routine, trying to commit to a yoga practice, and they're just not following through. And people use terms like lack willpower, lack motivation, self-sabotage. People say things like this, and I don't really know that that's true. You know, I've changed my life a number of different times, and I continue to change it, but I've had the luxury of moving all the time, lots of different places. I've lived in different places. I've been surrounded by very different people, and one of the big luxuries of travel and living in different places, and this was true when I lived in the States too, I still lived all over the place, is you get to recreate yourself. And you know, in one place you might be Luke the druggie, and in another place you're Lucas and you're sober. And in one place you might be, you know, the bored office worker Luke, and then you go to another place and you're Lucas and you're into healthy eating and exercise and yoga, and you get to recreate yourself. And when you move somewhere new, when you change your environment, tell people what you're into and they take you at face value. They don't have 25 years of childhood history to hold you to, and experiences and references and things like that. There's a bunch of downsides of living internationally, but one of the upsides is you get to be who you want to be and you can start over. But what do you do if you're in an environment right now that's not really working for you and you're thinking about things that are big, like losing 40 pounds or like completely changing your career or like evacuating from a toxic relationship or like moving house or something major like that? It can be really exciting and overwhelming at the same time. Let's just choose the weight loss goal, for example. Let's say it's 40 pounds and it needs to go, and you know it needs to go. And it's exciting to talk about, it's exciting to think about, but it's also really, really overwhelming because you've been carrying that weight for 20 years, right? What if it doesn't work out? You should be afraid of that, what if it doesn't work out, because it's a real fear, and you only get so many failures in life. There's this idea that you can just get kicked down and get up, kicked down and get up. I don't think it's true. I think you get kicked down enough, and at some point, you just stay down. I know that that's true for me, and I think it's true for most people. So how do you keep from getting kicked down? One of the simplest ways is to aim lower. Really, aim lower, right? And so rather than shooting for the moon, you just make little baby steps all the time. This is why I'm such a big advocate of 15-minute per day yoga practices. We just have such great success with this because it's such a small ask, and it leads and it stacks to more things. People always ask, but is it enough? Enough for what? It's enough for growth. It's enough for improvement. It's enough to feel good. And over time, things really do start to move. So let's go back to this goal. Maybe it's 40 pounds. You need to lose it. What can you do? I don't know, but you can do something today. You can do one thing today that you can get excited about and that you can win. Maybe it's a 1 mile walk around the block. Maybe it's increasing your water intake. Maybe it's increasing the time between your dinner and your breakfast so it goes up to at least 12 hours. Really, really small changes, and you can stack win on win on win. Tiny habits is the term that my guest on this week's show uses to talk about these incremental small wins stacked over time, compounding over time, leading to big, big changes, massive changes in your life, not by gritting your teeth and bearing it, not by hustle or grind, but really simply by getting to know yourself, thinking about what makes you tick, what makes you excited, doing more of that, and then stacking win upon win upon win. My name is Lucas Rockwood. It's the Lucas Rockwood Show. If you're new here, this show is really an excuse for me to go out in the world, find people, experts in health and wellness, personal growth and development, and I bring their best work here to you on the show, hopefully to help you live a more inspired, more healthy life, On this week's show, we'll be chatting with BJ Fogg. He's at Stanford, he's a researcher, and he's doing some really cool stuff. I think you'll find it really helpful. As always, one of the best ways you can show your support for the show is simply to share it. Share it with somebody you know, share it on social media, tag me, it's at Lucas Rockwood. If you have questions, I'd love to have your voice on the show. Send me a voice message, go to yogabody.com/AskLucas, and send a question, send a comment, we'll use your recording, we'll put it on the podcast, and I'll talk right to you on the show. Thanks for listening. Hello and welcome, everyone. Today's show is called Tiny Habits That Lead to Big Changes. I am joined here with Dr. BJ Fogg. Dr. Fogg founded Behavior Design Lab at Stanford University, where he directs research and innovation. He teaches innovators how to use his models in behavior design, which we'll be chatting about today. All of his research, all of his teachings to help people improve their lives. He's the author of a number of books, Persuasive Technology was one of his first books, co-editor of Mobile Persuasion, and his newest book, which is not out yet, but coming soon, is called Tiny Habits, The Small Changes That Change Everything. We'll be chatting about today. You can learn more at his websites, tinyhabits.com or behaviormodel.org, behaviormodel.org. BJ, welcome to the show.
Lucas, thank you for inviting me.
So when people are looking at making changes in their life, it always comes down when I'm at a conference or a meeting or even just a social event when people talk about stuff. You know, I mean, I'm a yoga teacher and stuff like this, so people are always talking about weight loss or New Year's resolutions. People always say things like, I just could never motivate to do that. And I really question... There are people like myself, which one of my gifts is I have maniacal focus. And so I could be all alone on an island and I would probably still do an hour of reading and study and an hour of exercise and no one would care. And I would do it for myself because I'm neurotic. But most people are not like that. And I find that most people, I don't really find that there's an unequal distribution of willpower, at least from the people that I've worked with in health and wellness circles, but I don't know how to really address this. And I know that this is something that obviously you've invested a lot of time and research and study into. So how do you think about willpower specifically?
Yeah. Well, when it comes to change, it's actually easier than most people think, if you do it in the right way. If somebody says, oh, I really don't want to work. I don't want to work out for an hour a day, but that's what I'm going to do. And somehow I'm going to force myself to do it. Yeah, you're not going to have the motivation or probably the willpower to do that. And so that's just the wrong direction. The right approach is to focus on what you actually want and specific behaviors that you like doing and you want to do, and then you don't have to tap into willpower. And we'll get into more of the details. But to answer your question, willpower, if you're tapping into willpower to make lasting change, that's a signal that you need to redesign what you're doing. I'll get a little bit geeky here. I see two sides to willpower, and I'll describe it kind of in terms of my behavior model, but people can't see the model. So basically, there's one kind of willpower to keep yourself going. One of my students runs 100-mile races in the wilderness, 100 miles, and he does it in about 15 or 16 hours. And so he's going along around 20 miles, piece of cake, 40, 50, 60 miles. He has to keep himself going, and he knows how to do that. He knows how to tap into willpower, tap into techniques to keep it going. So there's one kind of willpower to keep yourself going, despite the fact that you're in pain or you don't want to. There's another type of willpower to continue to say no to like a temptation, like you're sitting at dinner and then there's this great dessert in front of you and you're like, no, I'm not eating dessert. And you keep saying no, 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 no. So that's stopping yourself from doing something. Both of those things are not the optimal way to design for everyday people to design change in your life.
So, because both of those require so much effort, I'm guessing, is the reason, right?
Yeah. And right. And willpower. And what you're doing is you are fighting a drive to either like, oh, I'm in pain and I've got to like keep going, or I'm being tempted and I continue to be tempted and I want it, but I can't. And so that just creates conflict and you wear out after a while.
There's these memes that go around online, you know, fail hard, fail often, try big things. And you're kind of in the heart of this in Silicon Valley and things like this. But I really balk at that advice. I've done a lot of things in my life and I failed a lot, but like I'm not recommending that to anybody, you know, whether it's relationship failures or business failures, whatever kind of failure. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could tell you stories all day, but I don't recommend anyone do. I avoid those potholes at all costs. And I'm just curious, you know, in terms of tiny habits that lead to big change, that's what immediately comes to my mind. It's like, that's really sage advice, because I see so many people dreaming. I'll give you a specific example. I was talking to an old friend, and I was at a wedding, and he was saying, an old childhood friend, he was saying, yeah, my buddies and I, three of us, you know, we've saved up some money, and the three of us are going to open a restaurant. And he's like, I heard you used to own a restaurant. I was like, yeah, I did. He's like, what do you think of it? I was like, I think it's a lousy business. You know, on the best case scenario, you know, these guys are hoping to break even in 7 years. These are like big restaurants.
Yeah.
I was like, this is a lousy business. And he kind of looked at me and he's like, well, you know what? We're just going to go for it. You got to take risks in life. You got to go big. And I was just like, he's been reading this crap online. He's been reading these memes, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't want to be a dream. I don't want to be a dream killer. At the same time, like, why doesn't the guy go sell? I don't know, tacos on the beach, or like, you know, like this tiny habit thing. Like, I like to win, and I mostly don't. You know, I'll take any win that I can get. I'll take a high five from my kids. I'll take. I'll take a 7% margin. You know, whatever. All of it's awesome. But this idea of like going big, failing hard, getting back up, like. I don't have the stamina for that, and I've got stamina, you know? I mean, I have willpower to burn, but man, those failures, they grind on me. I don't forget, you know? And I don't wear them like a badge of honor, that's for sure. So I'm curious how you think about this, because you're way deeper into the clinical and actual study of things.
Well, I hear you for sure on that. Let me distinguish for people this whole Silicon Valley meme around that. When you have a venture-backed company, so you have professional investors putting money in, they don't want incremental returns. That money is supposed to get them massive returns, 100x. So they want you to go big, and they want you to just go out there. If you're starting your own company and you're bootstrapping, then you don't want to, you know, take a huge, massive failure. And certainly when you're trying to change your own behavior in your own life, that's different than having a venture-backed, you know, company. And the way you, as you know, the way you achieve big results is through tiny changes and consistency. That's how you reliably get to the big outcomes.
The parallels to health and wellness, though, I don't think they're so different. I meet people all the time who say, you know, in 2020, I want to run and, you know, I want to complete an Ironman. And it's like, well, that's great. Like, how about if you and I do like 3K right now, you know, forget about the Ironman. Like, let's just stack a win. I mean, it's a great night. Let's strap on the shoes. Let's do a 3K. Oh, no. I'm going to get this book. I'm going to get this. I'm going to get this coach and this trainer. And, I love this. The easy wins, you know? So I guess it comes back to this other idea, you know, easy versus hard in terms of stacking the deck. In your favor, you know, there's whatever that book is, you know, the hard things about hard things. It really comes out of our culture right now. This idea that everything needs to be hard and it's all grind and hustle and big. And, I mean, winners come out of that, but mostly it's losers, like 98%, you know, so.
Right. I mean, and you watch TV shows about people making these massive transformations, but that's why those people are on TV shows. It's the exception. It's not how things normally work. It does take, Lucas, a bit of courage to go tiny, because just even yourself, you may be like, oh, why am I not doing big things and so on. But if people are thinking, oh, I'm going to do this huge thing, this marathon, what often happens, and you implied this, is they procrastinate or they find all these other things they have to do besides just start. And that's one of the main things about tiny habits early in the book. I say, if it's so tiny, you can just get started. Just dive in. You don't have to plan much. And guess what? If it's tiny, you don't have to tell anybody. So you're not putting yourself up for any kind of social scrutiny or criticism or whatever. And even unfortunately, as you probably know, Lucas, in people's lives, sometimes people's spouses will sabotage their effort, which is really sad. But you can just sneak it in and go ninja if it's tiny. You know, you're just eating a snack differently, or you're just tweaking these things, and there's two things that happen. A lot of things happen when you go tiny, but tiny can grow, and it grows in two ways. The small things you're doing will grow. So if you're meditating for just three breaths or a minute, over time, you can grow that and meditate more and more. It's a natural process. So the habit itself will grow. The other way that it expands is through multiplication, if I can say that word. The other way it grows is it multiplies. The habit will inspire you to do other related habits. And so instead of having just this one huge habit, you have a whole collection of things. And when you're looking at lasting change or transforming your life in any domain, it's not really about one magical habit that gets you there. It's really about the collection. And with Tiny, you can get started right away and you can build that collection of habits quickly and naturally.
So what is this behavior design lab? This sounds like a dream project for people. Tell us what that's about. What have you been up to?
Yeah, I've run a lab at Stanford for 20 years now. And there's about 8 to 12 students at any time who are researchers in the lab. They're not full-time, it's part-time. We meet once a week, and we have about three projects going at all times. The first 10 years, we called the lab the Persuasive Technology Lab. And we were investigating how computers could change people's attitudes and behaviors, so studying that scientifically. And then about 2009, Lucas, I ran a class at Stanford on health habits. So I can teach anything I want at Stanford. And so every year I come up with a new topic, and there was a year I thought, okay, let's look at health habits. Nothing to do with technology. And that was really inspiring and interesting. And so that some of those students joined my lab, and the lab transitioned away from technology in about 2009, 2010. And we were more interested in just how human behavior worked and how to help people have healthy habits and so on. And so we renamed the lab a little while later to the Behavior Design Lab. And it's all about some aspect of how do you help people change for the better, what drives change, and so on. So there's a whole bunch of topics that fit under that. And the topics are really driven by what the students are interested in doing. And for example, this last year, one of the students was interested in boosting women's confidence in cryptocurrency. Because I know, like, right? So she was from Jamaica, and she felt that the women there needed to scale up and be more confident in the financial domain. And then she thought cryptocurrency was the future. So she put those two together and we looked at that. This year, we've done a big project on how to help people reduce screen time. And so the projects can vary widely, but it all comes back to behavior and how to help people change their behavior for the better.
And give me some, or give listeners some examples of some tiny habits that you've seen play out in your research or in your own life that are really, that were just kind of exciting surprises in terms of the downstream effects.
Yeah, I'll give a few. One habit, this is the only habit I prescribe in the book. There's only one. Everything else in the book is that here's how to make any habit you want a reality. But in the book, I prescribe one, and I call it the Maui habit. And the Maui habit is after your feet touch the floor in the morning, when you go to get out of bed, you say, it's going to be a great day. You just say that phrase, those seven words. And that has much more power than people expect. So if somebody's listening to this and they think, that just sounds all woo-woo, California craziness, try it. And if you're skeptical, like some days I get up and I'm like, oh, it's going to be such a hard day. I say, it's going to be a great day. Somehow, you know, so I'm not naive about it, but that's a great habit. There's just the ripple effects from that on your day are big. And it's not just me. It's so many people have told me how effective that is in their life that I put that habit in the first chapter and it's the only one I prescribe. Other habits that have really resonated with people and opened the door is, and I know this is going to sound weird, but so I just started doing this on a whim and then shared it. Now lots of people do it. After I pee, I do two push-ups. Now, some people do squats, some people do other things, but there's something about bringing Exertion, like using your muscles 5 to 7 times a day, that just opens the door to do other things, like a gateway.
If you're looking to improve your indoor air quality, take care of your household, take care of your family, air filtration is becoming more and more important. Thanks to Molecule Air Filters for sponsoring the show. This is a new type of air filtration system that destroys pollutants at the molecular level. You can save 10% with your first order if you go to molecule.com. It's molekule.com and use code ROCKWOOD10 at checkout. Thanks to Molecule for sponsoring the show.
Just opens the door to do other things, like a gateway. And also, with push-ups, you actually do get stronger. Now, I don't just do 2. I do more than that. But the tiny version, all I'm required to do is just do two push-ups. I do the 2 push-ups, and then sometimes I vary them. Right now, rather than the push-ups, because I have a little bit of a shoulder issue from stand-up paddleboard surfing, now I do really deep squats. So I'll go back to the push-ups once my shoulder is substantially healed. But, you know, after I pee, I do 2 really deep squats. In fact, I'm doing them right now as I'm talking to you. And I've gotten better. And I actually like doing them now. And the fact that it was only 2 made it easy. And I didn't procrastinate or resist. And I'll go back to push-ups at some point. But it's just bringing that little bit of using your muscles hard throughout the day just has this great effect. So I'll stop there. But there are so many simple things like that that you can bring into your day that change you in that moment, but also have ripple effects through the rest of the day.
Earlier, we talked about the kind of sheer willpower force it takes to run 100 miles in 13, 14 hours, or the sheer willpower force it takes not to eat the Christmas cakes and New Year's stuff that's going to show up here in a couple of months. And so I guess the question that I'm leading to is how, you know, when you think about tiny habits and you think about changes and you think about just kind of reducing decision-making fatigue and environment, and mm-hmm. obviously you've spent a ton of time looking at technology in terms of the good, the bad, and the ugly. How do you think about setting up an environment that just makes it easier for you to succeed?
Super important, super important. I started teaching tiny habits in 2011, I think. And that was after, I had that health habits class. I started goofing around with my own behaviors, came up with this method I call tiny habits. I know it works for me like crazy. So I started teaching it in 2011 to other people to see, could this help other people? And from the beginning, I knew that people needed to also change their environment. So the phrasing and the wording is, I think, exactly the same now. If you like look at the Tiny Habits website, it's like, hey, there's 3 ways to change your behavior in the long term. There are 3. Number 1, you can have an epiphany. Guess what? You can't make yourself have an epiphany. Yeah. You can't design one for other people. So yes, they happen, and yes, they can be transformative, but don't count on it. So now let's go to the next one. You can change your environment. Good. You can do this. Redesign your environment to make the good behaviors easy to do, bad ones hard to do. That's great. And then the third one is to make these small incremental changes and make them habits. And so those last 2, the environment redesigns and these incremental changes in wiring and the habits work together. And that's really what you're doing to create lasting change.
I guess the challenge with the epiphany, aside from not being able to create it, is they usually come from pain. that's usually where the epiphany comes from, like a bankruptcy, a divorce, a heart attack. Like, at least from what I've seen, you don't have a whole bunch of people just, you know, walking around suddenly being, it usually comes from wrapping your car around a tree or something. That's when these epiphanies come.
And it definitely doesn't come from data or reading a scientific article.
Totally.
Or tracking your behavior. I mean, that was sort of the thought of the quantified self movement back in the day. Like, oh, people just had data. They just had the data, they would change. And no, information alone does not change people in the long term.
It's a really great, and I've had a bunch of quantified self biohacker people on the show, and it's a really fatal flaw that nobody talks about. You're right. Just having the data doesn't actually help. You know, I teach people to check their blood sugar aside from checking their weight and all this kind of thing. It doesn't really, I mean, for some people it helps. It helps add a layer of intelligence, but yeah, it's not the epiphany. They really do need to wrap the car around a tree in order to have
the data alone. I don't want to prescribe reckless driving, but certainly the data alone is not. It can help certain people. It can discourage other people. And the bottom line is this: one of the things I talk about for years in my work in terms of products and now in terms of personal change is to help people feel successful. And in this case, it's help yourself feel successful. So if a sleep tracker, or a step counter, or a bathroom scale, if that helps you feel successful, then use it. That's great. If any of those things set you up to feel unsuccessful, like getting on the scale, then don't use it. When you feel unsuccessful, that is a setback for change. When you see you're succeeding, that propels you forward. So the exact same device, the exact same tracker, the exact same data may work differently for different people. But the bottom, I call it a maxim, fog maxim number two is help people feel successful. And if it's yourself, help yourself feel successful. And so if they help you in feeling like you're succeeding, go for it. Otherwise, don't do it.
And when looping back to the environment thing, if that's one of the major ways that you can set yourself up for success, what kinds of things, specific or general, should people think about?
So much. First and foremost, think about your home environment. It's great if people can change the workplace so it's easier to eat better and be more active and reduce your stress, but you may not have that much control. But around your home environment, your household, the household is a great unit of change. So in our home, in the fridge, we call it super fridge. There's food there, healthy food ready to go. It doesn't have any food that's off our game plan. Nothing goes in there that I can open the fridge and eat anything I want at any time. There's no willpower. So design the fridge. For things like stress reduction, I have little myofascial devices around the house where I read, where I watch TV. I have musical instruments. It's sad to say, but kind of all over the house, not in the bedroom, but kind of everywhere else, whether it's guitar, piano, flute. Because for me, playing a musical instrument is just powerful. Yes, it's calming. It's like meditation, but it's something more than that. So the fact that I have, two ukuleles, three guitars, five flutes out, eight more in the drawer, and so on. That's not an accident. I want to make it really easy to play music because for me, I found that's really helpful. So just put the tools that you need around and not even in a drawer. I have a drawer full of, sounds terrible, full of these different kinds of flutes. And then I take out my three favorite and they're just sitting out because the opening the drawer and taking them out turns out to be too hard. Okay, surprisingly, it's too hard. But by setting it out, then I see it and it prompts me and it's easier to do. Now, when guests come, I put them away. But in my normal course, to get things out that you need, even something like collagen powder. Say you want to do collagen. Okay, so my collagen powder has this screw top on it. It takes two hands and it's like, whatever. So then I've taken and put it in a different container that just takes one hand. One hand can take off the lid. The other hand scoops it. I pour it in. I close it. It's done. Now that sounds like, what's the difference? There's a huge difference from having to unscrew this kind of clunky plastic thing to a one-handed smooth process. That difference, that shift can make the difference between success and failure right there.
You know, people listening to this are going, that's so silly, that's so small. But like, if you look at the stats, people are dying, millions of people are dying every year from not taking life-saving medications, whether it's Lipitor or other drugs to control. Hypertension is probably the most common one. People are dying, right? They have these prescriptions they're supposed to take. And that stupid childproof lock and that little, that it's enough friction that they risk their life. You know what I mean? So if somebody's willing to risk their life, like, you're going to totally risk your collagen powder. It's not that, you know what I mean? So I do the exact same thing. I have, it's funny you mentioned the guitar thing. My guitar is in its case, and I was just moving it last night. I was like, why haven't I taken this out? My case is kind of a pain in the ass, and my daughter never puts hers in her case, so I play hers all the time, and I like mine better, you know? So I'll go in her room to say goodnight, and I'll play hers instead of mine. And I have a drum. I have like a hung drum that's out all the time. And I play it, again, just because it's out.
You know, really?
I'll start playing it, and then I'll sit down and be like, oh, yeah, I'll play a bit more. And then the other thing I do exactly as you is I have identical vitamins.
I'm playing my drum, my bass drum. It's out. Keep going.
Yeah,
we gotta do a little jam.
So I have identical vitamins in my office as I have in my home. So again, I don't have to remember or forget. They're just there.
Yeah. You know?
So I'll run into them at one point during the day.
Exactly.
I don't have to carry some, you know, grandpa vitamin pill thing around with me or whatever. Just stick them everywhere. But I think, you know, stacking your environment in a way that makes it easy is such a crucial thing. And when you look at most people's houses, it's mostly a bunch of landmines. And what I mean by that is you open the freezer and there's five different flavors of Ben and Jerry's, and you go through the house and there's just massive screens everywhere that are wired to Netflix and, you know, all kinds of silly things. Like, I don't have a Netflix account. And of course, my kids have one somewhere, but like, it's too much pain to actually log in. So I just haven't watched Netflix in, like, I don't know, a really long time. There's little simple things. You can flip it too. You can add just enough friction that you can't be bothered, you know, adding a password to this and that. It's just enough to keep you away.
Exactly. I mean, we can go on and on about these tweaks you make in your environment that have a big impact. And it's, you know, that if you change your environment, sometimes that naturally leads to these new habits or adding friction, stopping them. But I think what people need to keep in mind, it's these two things together, you know, taking these baby steps. And I think tiny habits is the best way to do that. Plus changing your environment, and they work together. And that's how you get there. That's how you reach the big outcomes, and that's how you succeed.
And so you've put together this book, and it sounds like you've been doing this work long before the book came out. But what is your hope when the book comes out? What are you hoping to share with people?
Number one, that you can change, and it's easier than you think. And that the times that you haven't been able to succeed in the past are not your fault. It's just you didn't have the right approach. Number two, that the best way to change is by feeling good, not by feeling bad. And since the beginning of Tiny Habits, and I really turned up the volume on this idea in the book, because people need it so much. What wires in a new habit is not repetition. It is the feeling of success as you do that behavior. And that feeling, that emotion wires it in. And so that's a positive emotion. And so not only does it wire in the habit, it has other positive effects. So what one of the things I really want people to do is take that seriously. And if you are feeling guilty or shameful or like you lack willpower, whatever, guess what? Back up. You're not approaching it in the best way. There are ways to change where you are celebrating every tiny success. And there are ways, changes that happen quite naturally. And then I guess the third thing would be bring this to people that are around you, people you love, people you work with, and so on, and change together. Changing as a household together is important for things like nutrition, stress reduction, sleep. If one person tries to change alone in those domains and the rest of the household is doing other things, it's really tough. So having other people join you in this, actually it's fun if you do it right. It's a fun exploration of, hey, let's change our environment and change our habits over the long term. So we have less stress, or we have more energy, or we sleep better, or more productive, any of those things. And going back to the first point, all of that is easier than most people think. And I guess I'll just add one more bonus thing. There's so much stuff out there about behavior change, the traditional wisdom that is wrong and misleading. And so people need to be discriminating and understand that not everything you read about how behavior works or how to change your behavior is accurate. A lot of it, either it's not accurate or it doesn't work in the real world. And so don't think everything out there is in line with how behavior really works or how you achieve big outcomes.
I'd be remiss if I didn't dig a little deeper on this one, but you know, people, let's say you got a husband and a wife and the husband stops drinking, wife doesn't. Like, that's such a difficult situation.
Yeah.
Or one person suddenly just becomes fanatical about obstacle races or something like that, and the other is really into Game of Thrones, and that's their thing. Is there any hope? I get this question a lot from students coming to courses and things like that, and they're saying, you know, I found yoga and it's completely changed my life, and my husband or my partner's not on board. What should I do? And I never have a good answer. And I just don't even want to get into that because I'm worried that my answer is just not good. I'm curious what your research has shown.
Yeah, so here's what I'm seeing, and I'll boil it down to practical terms. First of all, don't nag. So there's two maxims I push really throughout the book. One is help yourself feel successful. The first maxim is help people do what they already want to do. Now, that includes yourself. That means don't pick something you feel like you should do, pick your want. But that relates to your partners and your kids and people around you. Help them do what they already want to do. So if they don't want to go run obstacle courses, don't push that on them. But listen or be very attentive to the good things they want to do and support them. Let me give an example. So my partner grew up in a very primitive environment on the land and didn't even have indoor plumbing. So for him, the idea of going and lifting heavy objects just to lift them is like crazy. Why would you do that? You know, instead build a fence. Yeah, right. And I know the importance of strength training, especially as you get older. But there wasn't really anything I could do to convince him of it. Then one day, he, at our home in Maui, there's a gym right nearby, he discovered a rowing machine, a Concept 2 rower, and he loved it. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I would have never, never thought this would be the match for you. But he loved this rowing machine. So we talked about it. We talked about how he's doing. I helped him feel successful by pointing out his progress. Back here in California in my home gym that I have, guess what we bought? A Concept 2 rower. Guess what he does every morning at 5? He can't wait. He gets up and goes out and rows.
Wow,
now
crazy.
That is helping him do what he wanted to by the rower. I helped him feel successful by pointing out his successes. And now he's getting into weight training. Now he wanted to buy this kind of universal gym. I'm not a fan of those, but I wasn't going to say no because it's like weight training. We bought that. And so now he is on the path of doing resistance training, which he never would have done if I had just been nagging him, but I supported him in helping him do what he already wanted to do. And in the pattern is then it expands. So the rowing expanded to other things and got to the strength training that I think is so important for all of us as we age.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I love that you had a positive story. I mostly see the follow the other side where, you know, the people that got you to where you are aren't the people who are going where you're going. And especially with the big things, you know, like drugs and alcohol and lifestyle. And if somebody wants to make a really major shift, if they've gone pretty deep down one of those paths, you want to make a pretty major shift. Unfortunately, sometimes there's going to be some fallout and there's just no, it's just so hard to make that kind of change if you don't have the person laying next to you in bed supporting you.
Yeah.
If that person's trying to sabotage you, it's a tough one.
Take a while. Okay. So on my musical endeavors, my partner does not support the flute.
Yeah.
And before the flute, it was slide whistle, and he hated that. But Lucas, I got really good on the slide whistle. I think I was top 10 in the world, but it drove him insane. So I'd have to go outside, and I was like, fine, let's find a different woodwind instrument that you like. And it turned out this tenor flute, he can tolerate. So that's fine. But still, he doesn't love it. But on the flip side, I just don't think nagging is the right way. It's just stay tuned. Change leads to change. So if you can support them in any type of positive change, you will open the doors for other types of change.
I love your message. I love your work you're doing here. I'm excited for your book to come out, BJ. For people listening, where would you like us to send them in terms of following you online?
Well, if you want to dive into Tiny Habits, yes, the book is the best way. You can also go to tinyhabits.com and join the free 5-day program that's always going to be free, and now 40, 50,000 people have gone through it. If you want to find more about my work more broadly, it's bjfogg.com. And then on Twitter or Instagram, I have a weird name, so it's kind of great. I'm always at BJ Fogg. So any of those any of those things at BJ Fogg, you can, and Twitter and Instagram are both, I don't post pictures of sunsets and the food I'm eating. It's really both of those channels are to help people understand how behavior works and apply it. So those would be the best ways.
Well, BJ, thanks so much for coming on the show. I'm excited for your book. Good luck with the launch, and let's keep in touch for the future. If you've taken any yoga class, you've no doubt heard your yoga teacher talk about the importance of breathing. Breathe slowly, breathe deeply, breathe through your nose. But it doesn't really go much further than that in terms of the how or the why, the physiology behind breathing, why we're doing it, why it matters. Oddly, yoga, despite the fact that breathing is always emphasized, doesn't really do a good job of teaching breathing. I don't know why. It's lacking from almost every yoga tradition. And the science, which is not new at all, it's been around for over 100 years, is almost completely absent from the tradition as well. And this was something that really frustrated me when I first started doing yoga and kept me frustrated for about 5 years. And I've since had the privilege to work with, to speak with, to interview, and to get consultations from some of the best breath researchers and teachers in the world. Most of them are outside of the yoga community, but I've taken all those teachings and brought them back into the yoga community. And I've put together a new course. It's called Breath Coach Training, and it's designed to help you or other teachers or would-be teachers learn how to use breath in a coaching setting. And so if you want to help somebody relieve stress, sleep better, balance their mood, improve their digestion, all of the nervous system benefits that breath can be of assistance with, this is the training for you. Breath is not a panacea, meaning it's not a cure-all, it's not going to reverse cancer or anything like that, but it is the most immediate way to affect your nervous system of anything. It's faster than a pill. There is nothing that is as quick and as predictable and safe as breathing. In as little as 5 or 10 minutes, you can make a massive, massive shift in your autonomic nervous system that has trickle-down effects into your endocrine system, trickle-down effects into your mood and your metabolism. And it's very predictable, and it gets clients really, really excited. Who needs this? Well, anyone who has trouble sleeping, anyone who struggles with digestion, anyone who has up and down moods throughout the day, food cravings, for example, anyone who has overwhelming stress and anxiety. And I think I've pretty much encapsulated every single person on planet Earth right now. But the great thing about breathing is it's a lot more accessible than meditation. Meditation is experiencing a resurgence of popularity, maybe hasn't been this popular since the Maharishi in the 60s and 70s. But the reality is most people aren't practicing meditation. In fact, many of you listening right now have meditation apps on your phone that you're not using. You have meditation books on your shelf that you read, but you didn't sit down and do a meditation practice last night. And a big part of that is that meditation can go sideways, and people don't talk about this, but rumination is a huge problem with meditation. This is where you sit down with all the best intentions, and for 20 minutes, all you think about is that person at work who is causing you stress and anxiety and treating you horribly. All you think about is that relative or that in-law who is abusive and walking all over you, and your mind spins and spins and spins, and 20 minutes later, you don't actually feel better. Meditation is amazing. I've spent something like 43 days of my life in silence, sitting on my butt, doing nothing, and it's been transformative. But it can go wrong, and on a daily basis, out of the context of a monastery, out of the context of a temple, out of the context of a controlled environment, it does go wrong very, very often. It's not dangerous, but it's not that productive. You can sometimes finish a meditation session feeling more rotten than when you went in, and this happens a lot. This is why people default to mantra. This is why people default to prayer. This is why some people just read a book, or why most people just flip on Netflix. Sitting silently with your own thoughts is sometimes spending 10 or 20 minutes with a special kind of evil friend who smashes your brain about. And breathing gives you something to do. It's an active form of meditation. It's a lot more accessible. most importantly, the results are very, very predictable. I don't in any way want to discourage you from meditation, but nobody's having these open discussions about the way meditation, the real challenges of meditation, which is it doesn't always work and the barrier to entry is huge. Breathing, the barrier to entry is pretty much zero. The results are almost guaranteed. There is a very, very predictable outcome, and the compliance is very high, meaning your ability to follow through is very, very good because it's not as scary as spending 10 or 20 minutes with your special evil friend, also known as your monkey mind. When you're spending time with your breath, you're literally spending 10 minutes with your own lungs, which is a lot less intimidating, and the outcome is a lot more predictable. To learn more about the course, check out breathcoachtraining.com. If you'd like to check out my TED Talk, it's called Change Your Breath, Change Your Life, and you'll get an idea about what I'm talking about. Hope you can join us. We'll talk to you soon. This week's nutritional tip is in response to a listener question. Listener JP on Facebook says, Lucas, I'm worried I have a food allergy. I'm getting a weird rash on my arms and my legs, and it doesn't seem to go away. It's not that serious, but it's very persistent. I wonder if it's related to food. Can you help? So food allergies are a really common thing, and they're a phantom thing. They come and they go. They're very unpredictable, and they're often not for life. So even a kid might have a really severe milk allergy. They might grow out of it. An adult might have this temporary peanut allergy, and they could grow out of it as well. One of the bigger challenges is that the most allergenic foods are some of the most common foods in the world, like milk and eggs and wheat and soybean and peanuts. Seafood, not that common, but nuts and seeds and all these kinds of things can be really allergenic. So what do you do if you're allergic to milk or eggs or wheat or soybeans? And how do you even go about figuring it out? Well, you can go in and get allergy tests done. And the problem is almost everybody who does this comes back positive, and you'll probably come back for something that you never even thought of before. So sometimes it can be better actually just to do an elimination diet to test. And so if you take those top allergens, JP, like milk and eggs and soybean and wheat, and you do like 7 or 10 days without them and then see what happens with your skin, sometimes that can be even more effective than going to an allergist and trying to figure out what's happening there. Because again, these things can come and go, and they may or may not show up on tests. Sometimes you get false positives, and it can be really frustrating. But I think your questioning is great, and it's very likely that something could be there. And oftentimes these things will be cascading. So a food allergy will come along with a compromised immune system or a stress response or something like that. But unfortunately, the only way to really figure it out is, it's not always the case. You know, you can get a gluten test and things like that. But in most cases, you actually need to play around with elimination, 7 to 10 days, and then reintroduction can be a really good way to go. If you pick one at a time and kind of treat it like an experiment, it can kind of be a fun adventure. But again, these foods are so common, you do have to be really strict. Hope that's helpful. We have a listener question from listener Ali. Ali says, Hi Lucas, I practice Hatha Yoga 5 to 6 times per week, and I feel like I'm not getting enough out of my practice anymore. I'm getting bored with doing the same poses constantly. I want to learn more poses to deepen my practice. What do you suggest I do? Ali, I appreciate the honesty. This happens to almost everybody. Yoga practice, and really any practice, doesn't matter if you're practicing a musical instrument or meditation or yoga, it goes in phases, and there's phases where you're really excited about it and phases where you're bored out of your brain. And sometimes it means doing something new. So I'd encourage you to try a different style of class. If you only have access to like a traditional Hatha class, like you mentioned, that could get boring, but anything can get boring. But maybe try something totally out of the box, like a hot yoga class, a flow and ashtanga class. See if something resonates with you. My other suggestion is maybe try something totally different altogether, like Pilates or group fitness or anything to keep yourself excited. I always say the best class to go to is the one that you're excited about. And really, I wouldn't get too strict on defining that. Just try to figure out what works for you. Online resources can be a good way to go. I will say, though, that most people really struggle with at-home practice, at least for long form. We do really well with short mobility hygiene stuff, 15 minutes per day. But in terms of like a full 1 hour practice, most people really prefer to be in a class. And so if you can, I'd encourage you to get out there and try something new. Thanks for writing in.
This week's iTunes review is by Judy Joy from USA. Judy Joy says, I'm thrilled to have found this podcast. I'm practically binge listening to the catalog of prior episodes because I can't get enough. Amazing variety of topics and guests focused on whole body wellness. Definitely a must listen. Great website as well. Thank you, Judy Joy. You have won the Yoga Trapeze. Email us at podcast@yogabody.com and we will get it to you.
If you're a regular Yoga Talk Show listener, you'll definitely want to get on my email list. Go to yogabody.com/sign-me-up. When you enter your email address there, we always have free giveaways every month. Yoga straps, water bottles, discounts in our shop, and all kinds of other things. When you sign up at yogabody.com/sign-me-up, I'll send you just one email a week with updates about the show, special offers, new courses, and valuable information that I think you'll find useful. So go to yogabody.com/sign-me-up to claim your free prize now.